When do hugs between a student and school employee add up to illegal sexual contact? Just one of the questions before the Iowa Supreme Court. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law is with us to explain the legal questions at the heart of cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. Also including the questions, if you neglect a property that becomes an eyesore, can the city take your property without paying you a dime? And can a person who pled guilty later challenge that plea and say, hey, I'm actually innocent? Also thoughts on whether Iowa's new fetal heartbeat law will be struck down. Checking the docket at the Iowa Supreme Court. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you neglect your property in a town or a city in Iowa, it becomes an eyesore. Can the city take it away from you without even paying a dime? Are surrogacy, gestational surrogacy contracts enforceable here in our state? And also, can a person plead guilty and then later challenge the constitutionality of that conviction on the grounds that he's actually innocent? Those are a few questions that have been busying the Iowa Supreme Court, and we're going to be diving into the cases, the stories behind Supreme Court cases in our state that you may have been hearing in our news, but we want to go behind the headlines, behind the decisions you've perhaps been following to explore these very interesting cases with Todd Pettis. He's the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Always a pleasure to have Todd with us. Thank you for coming in, Todd.
Thanks so much. I really enjoy this.
Okay. In addition to the cases, a little later in the hour, we're going to talk about, how Senator Grassley has been sort of nudging U.S. Supreme Court justices to retire, if they're thinking about retiring now. Some interesting comments there. And also, perhaps you've heard of the RBG documentary. Of course, that RBG refers to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's known by some as the notorious RBG. We'll get to that a little bit later in the hour. So much to get to. Let's get to our cases. And I want to remind our listeners, if you have any questions about the cases we're talking about this hour, please join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. In less than a half an hour, Todd, we have a press conference planned concerning the 72-hour waiting period in cases of abortion. This is a case, Planned Parenthood v. Reynolds, correct? Can you give us the background on this case?
Right. Well, there's actually two abortion-restricting laws Iowa has passed in the last year, one in May 2017, one in May 2018. The Reynolds case that you mentioned regarding the 72-hour waiting period, that's actually the one from 2017, and we've had litigation for that now for a while. It was orally argued in front of the Iowa Supreme Court in mid-February, and we should have a decision sometime before the end of the year. The press conference today is going to be held by Planned Parenthood of the Heartland and ACLU, we're told, announcing a new lawsuit against the more recent abortion statute, which is the fetal heartbeat bill. So we have 1 year, two different statutes, and we're soon going to have two different lawsuits going at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So we've got these two cases, a 72-hour waiting period for any when a woman asks for the procedure, an abortion. The other one, the fetal heartbeat bill, as soon as a heartbeat can be detected, which is as soon as, 6 weeks, then no longer is a doctor permitted to do an abortion.
Exactly, with very narrow exceptions. So let's separate these two laws and talk about them just briefly apart from one another. The one that Governor Reynolds signed just a week or two ago, that's the fetal heartbeat bill. That is a very restrictive law, as you say. That means about a month and a half on average into pregnancy. After that point, absent some kind of medical emergency or very dire circumstances, abortions will be flatly prohibited.
And, now, and we have to mention there, too, as a footnote, this is often in just in the reality of things, often before a woman even knows she's pregnant.
Exactly. That's right. And so this is, it's a very early time marker. And I can say with certainty that law will probably never actually go into effect in Iowa unless the case ultimately goes to the United States Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court announces new abortion law. And here's why that is. Under the federal constitution right now, a woman's right to abortion is defined in part as follows. Prior to viability, which is, you know, many months into pregnancy, prior to viability, a state cannot place an undue burden on a woman who wants to terminate the pregnancy. Or to put it in different language, a state can't impose a substantial obstacle on the woman. All right. Well, if the state is saying no abortions at all after the heartbeat is detected, there's no question that that's an undue burden, that it's a substantial obstacle, as the Supreme Court uses those terms. And two other states in this part of the country, have North Dakota and Arkansas, they passed in 2013 bills that for our purposes are just like this one. They were fetal heartbeat bills. And in both of those, the Federal Court of Appeals, which is the appellate court, which sits just below the United States Supreme Court and is responsible for Iowa and some other states here in this part of the Midwest. In both of those cases, the Eighth Circuit struck down those laws. Now, what's important here is the judges in those cases were all George W. Bush appointees. They made clear that they didn't like this outcome. If they were writing on a clean slate, the outcome may very well have been different. But those judges said, we are obliged. We have no choice. Right now, the Supreme Court says that this substantial obstacle test is the test. This is clearly a substantial obstacle because it's a flat ban, and so we cannot uphold it. If new law is going to be made here, it has to be made by the Supreme Court. And in both those cases, the states went to the United States Supreme Court and said, will you take this case, something called granting cert, which is just the term the court uses. And in both cases, the Supreme Court refused. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this afternoon, shortly here, maybe while we're even on the air, Planned Parenthood and ACLU are announcing reportedly they're going to go to court. A court will issue a stay, that is, prevent this law from going into effect because it is in violation of the current United States Supreme Court standard.
Now we're talking about the fetal heartbeat
exactly.
law.
Mm-hmm. So that law will not go into effect. I'm just confidently predicting. And then there'll be litigation on it. And that all the litigation there is all geared toward building the record, going through the hoops you need to go through in order to then present it to the United States Supreme Court and say, are you now willing to take another look at these abortion rules?
Okay. Two questions that follow on that. Is the U.S. Supreme Court currently likely to take on that? And I guess the second one that follows is we have the point of viability as prescribed by Roe v. Wade, 1973, will that potentially be moved up to, I mean, that's about 20 weeks, going down to 6 weeks, the fetal heartbeat measure, yardstick?
Sure. Okay. Well, the two cases, the fetal heartbeat bills from this part of the country that the Supreme Court refused to hear, one of those refusals was in 2015, one was in 2016. There's no, with Gorsuch replacing Scalia, there's no reason to think in my view, that the court as currently constituted is going to look more favorably on taking Iowa's case. The question is, if Justice Kennedy steps down between now and the time the Supreme Court is given that opportunity to look at this issue, if Justice Kennedy steps down, a new justice steps in, well, now we're starting to make further changes in the court's personnel, and we need four of them, not a majority, actually, but four of them to agree, yes, we want to take this case. So far, they haven't been able to get to four. When if you replace Justice Kennedy, maybe Justice Ginsburg, if she were to retire or something like that, now we have got a new group.
Okay, so it's four to say, yes, we want to take the case,
that's right.
but five to overturn perhaps Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the viability The focus on viability actually comes from Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a couple decades after Roe, that moved the court a little bit in a pro-life direction. And the issue in front of the Supreme Court in Iowa's case, if it gets that far, would be, is this viability standard, in fact, the wrong standard? And should we give states vastly more freedom to adopt the abortion restrictions that they may wish to adopt?
Todd Pettis is with us, University of Iowa College of Law professor. We're going through cases before the Iowa Supreme Court. Yes, it's also tied with the U.S. Supreme Court in this case. If you'd like to join our conversation discussing any of these cases, 1-866-780-9100. A lot on our docket, Todd. Are we finished up there?
Let me just add a quick footnote about the 72-hour waiting period. We mentioned that that case is pending in front of the Iowa Supreme Court. What that case is asking the Iowa Supreme Court is, does the Iowa Constitution itself provide a different set of protections for the woman seeking an abortion? And if so, are those protections even greater than the undue burden test we've been talking about? But with that clarification, I think we're ready for more.
Okay. Let's move on to a somewhat related case that involves surrogacy. Let's say you're a couple. I suppose you could be a same-sex couple and or not. And for whatever reason, you would ask someone else to carry your baby during the gestational period, right?
That's right. And some people whose memories stretch back a ways might remember there was at the time a very high profile case that really dominated news headlines in the 1980s called colloquially the Baby M case. And I think that was the first time, if it wasn't the first, it was one of the first, where a court had to look at these surrogacy contracts and decide whether they're enforceable. And a surrogacy contract is where you've got two different you have a couple that wants a baby, but they're unable to have one for physical reasons, or today we might say a same-sex couple, whatever the reasons. And they approach a woman who may or may not herself be in a relationship and say, will you carry this pregnancy to term so that we can then have the baby? And the Baby M case was the American judiciary's first take or one of their first takes on whether these contracts should be enforced. Well, Iowa finally had its case where they had to take a look at the same question. And this involved two couples. Their names aren't given in the record. They referred to as the M's and the B's. The first initial for the couple desiring a child is M. And then the surrogacy side, the one where the baby will actually be born, those are the B's. You can maybe think baby B's, you know, for where the baby is going to at least originate. So the M's and the B's, they meet up on Craigslist. The B's are looking for money. They're both married. They're both couples. The B's are looking for money because they're having their own trouble conceiving. And so they say, why don't we can make some money here by carrying through this pregnancy for the M's. We'll take the money that they give us, and that'll help us pay for our own fertility medical services that we're desiring. So they meet, and they settle on the fee of $13,000. That's how much the B's are going to be paid if this goes through successfully. Well, during the course of the pregnancy, the relationship between the two couples just really starts to fall apart. The B's evidently are posting some updates on social media about the pregnancy. The M's think of it as their pregnancy. They don't like the social media updates. There's disagreements about doctor's visits. Things really get ugly. The B's raise their price to about $30,000. Attorneys are hired, unfortunately, often not a good sign on how a relationship is going. And finally, the B's declare, you know, we're keeping the baby. And they just cut off communication with the M's. The M's have their eye on their calendar, and they get to the point where they know, well, surely Ms. B has had the baby by now. And actually, it's not the baby. There are two babies because there were two eggs, the fertilized eggs that were implanted, and they believed they were having twins. One of the babies dies after about a week. The B's don't tell the M's. The B's arrange their own the cremation services. Finally, there's court proceedings. All of this comes to light, and the court orders the baby, which I think our record refers to as Baby H. Baby H is ordered given to the M's, the couple that had wanted the baby. But then there's litigation about, was that the right outcome? Are these contracts enforceable? And the Iowa Supreme Court said, well, first of all, it'd be nice if our legislature had said something about what the correct answer here is and really gotten into this in detail. And they haven't said much. But there's one statute that says it's a crime to sell a person. And we do have a statute. It is a crime in Iowa to sell an individual. And in that statute, there's a little exception that says, but this doesn't apply to surrogacy motherhood agreements. And the Supreme Court says, well, there we see, albeit a little indirectly, and it's kind of small, there's no elaborate regulatory structure for these surrogacy arrangements. But there we see the legislature apparently giving its blessing to surrogacy agreements like this one. And so they hold that surrogacy contracts, in fact, are enforceable here in Iowa.
Mm. Interesting. Very involved, but interesting case. And that payment is a is seen as a compensation for caring.
For caring, exactly. It's not like you're going to sell me the baby when the baby is born.
Physically paying for property.
Exactly.
It is saying you have, as a mother, over 9 months and including the birth, endured quite a bit, and we're paying you for that.
That's right. Regardless of where the egg comes from, because there's different kinds of surrogacies, the Baby M case, the old case from the 1980s that I mentioned, there the woman who was going to become pregnant, it was her egg that was going to be fertilized by the sperm of the man and the couple that desired a baby. Here in this case, they're donated eggs, anonymously donated eggs. So the woman who's actually going to carry the child, it's not her egg and the sperm is not coming from her partner. Everything is coming from elsewhere. And the Iowa Supreme Court said it doesn't matter which of those kinds of surrogacies we're talking about. These contracts are enforceable unless there's evidence of fraud or something like that. So unless there's some unusual circumstances, Iowans are free to enter these kinds of arrangements.
Todd Pettis was with us at the University of Iowa College of Law, talking this hour about cases before the Iowa Supreme Court, most of them having been decided. Just talking there about one in which our state high court held that gestational surrogacy contracts are enforceable in Iowa. Todd, we have 6-7 minutes before we take a break. Let's dive into a couple interesting cases. This one, one involves whether you can, well, when there's a hug between a student and a school employee, when does that add up to illegal sexual contact? Tell us about State v. Wicks.
Right.
Wickes or Wicks?
I believe Wicks, though I've never heard it pronounced by Mr. Wicks himself, so I'm not certain. So we'll say Wicks. This case came down about a month and a half ago, and it made international headlines when it did. I found some clips from the UK, for example, and the headlines were all kind of incredulous, like, can you believe what they're doing now? And the headlines indicate, you know, the Iowa Supreme Court holds that it's sexual misconduct to hug a student. And, you know, if you just kind of approach the case at that depth, it does
sound ridiculous.
It sounds ridiculous. It sounds like the Me Too movement just gone totally off the rails or something like that. And in fact, there is a man, he's serving 5 years in prison for repeatedly hugging one of his students. But when you start to hear what happened, then you think, oh, okay, now it starts to make some sense. And here we refer to the student by her initials because she's a minor, it's A.S., and then Wicks. So Wicks is a social studies teacher in a high school, and A.S. is one of his students. She approaches him at the beginning of a school year and asks him to proofread an English paper that she's written. That night, he messengers him on Facebook's messenger program. And over the next month and a half, about 45 days, they exchange more than 1,000 messages that when you print them out, evidently fill up more than 600 pages. And in those messages, the teacher, Wicks, talks frequently about his marital dissatisfaction, his dissatisfaction with the lack of physical contact with his wife, and then pretty soon he's complimenting A.S., and they're starting to arrange hugs with each other. So they'll exchange messages, you know, I'll meet you at this certain time or something. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed my hug today. And I'll read you just a couple of the text messages that he says to her,
This is from the teacher
to the student. This is from the teacher to the student.
The student is how old?
She's, I think, 17.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to cross over to the creeper side a moment and tell you, you are hot and pretty, kind of a rare combo. Another message. I'm glad I just got to touch you. Another message. I don't know how to say this without violating my moral compass. That ought to be, you know, a little sign that maybe you should not say it. But in a different world, if time could be changed and I younger, you older, you'd be completely perfect for me. I'll read you one more here. Permission to be a pervy old man. Your eyes are amazing, freaking soulful and draws me in. And then the pervy stuff. You know you've got a great booty. Below that is some smoking legs that are beautiful and not the scrawny chicken legs like so many others. You've got a pinup girl build, an hourglass of curves. Read this, then delete, and I'll go turn myself in. Well, about a month and a half into this, he leaves his wife and children. That same day, they exchange messages. They agree to meet in a Walmart parking lot for their hug. They have their hug. They then go to their homes, and they keep messengering themselves late into the night. And in that exchange, he says, you know, what do you think about, you know, when you turn 18, when you graduate from high school, might there be something between us? I love you. And he describes the way he likes to give sensual massages. And he says, by the way, do you delete these? because I think I'd be killed if your dad found them. Well, essentially, dad found them. If two dads, actually, dad and a stepdad, they discover these messages, and they together take the phone to the police. And here's why this man is now in prison. It's a crime in Iowa to engage in sexual conduct for a school employee, for a school employee like a teacher, to engage in sexual conduct with a student for the purpose of satisfying sexual desires, mm-hmm. either on the part of the employee or the student. And the Supreme Court held in this case that when the statute refers to sexual conduct, the conduct does not itself have to be performing a sexual act. Indeed, there doesn't even need to be physical contact between them. They cite an earlier case from a couple of years ago where a teacher was taking sexual photographs of minors, children. He didn't actually touch the kids, but he was telling them how to pose, and he was taking the pictures, and that man was found guilty. And so the court held here, he was engaging in these hugs for the purposes of satisfying his own sexual desires. And the court went out of its way to say, we are not saying that you can't hug a student to comfort them, to celebrate something, kind of spur on the moment.
Right.
The kind that if you're the kind who's inclined to give hugs from time to time,
sure.
you don't have to worry about being convicted of sexual misconduct. You got to know something about this case to say, see the line.
Interesting. When you see headlines like, Iowa has banned hugging between teachers and students, all hugging, there is a larger...
There's a story.
There's a story. Thanks for getting behind that. We have about 3 minutes. I wonder, in a related case, this is really interesting that the court, Iowa Supreme Court, State v. Lopez, holding that texting a still image of one's genitals isn't indecent exposure.
Is not indecent exposure within the meaning of the statute. That's right. The legislature can change this. There's nothing constitutional about this, so it's not as if the Constitution demands this outcome. So the legislature can change this. But there's a statute that says that you're committing a crime if you expose your genitals to someone other than your spouse, and then, if it's going to be offensive, you should know it's offensive, words to that effect. And this man who was stalking a woman, she was not a willing recipient of this or any of his other contacts. That's exactly what he does. He texts himself an image of his genitals and with the message, me and my glory. He's later caught approaching her house after a no-contact order has been issued. He's arrested. So he's charged with stalking, for which he's doing up to 5 years in prison. But he's also going to be doing a year in prison for indecent exposure. And the Supreme Court said that in this statute, when they say expose, the legislature intended to be referring to an in-person encounter, not a digital image that you send to somebody else. They say, now, we're not saying what happens with something like Skype, where you're not physically in one another's presence, but you're conveying this image and it's live, or FaceTime or similar technology. But when you're sending a still digital image, that's not indecent exposure. The court drew a distinction and said, for example, it's one thing to get unwillingly to get this image sent to you on your phone. It's another thing if the guy's standing out in the sidewalk in front of your house exposing himself. One of those is more threatening. One of those is, it's not as easy to say, well, just look away if you don't like it, or just hit delete mm-hmm. if you don't like it. So at least for the time being, an in-person physical encounter is required for indecent exposure. And as I say, if the legislature wants to change that, it easily could. But, they're in recess and they haven't done that yet.
Okay, Todd Pettis talking about the State v. Lopez. That's a case that was before the Iowa Supreme Court. Holding that texting a still image of one's genitals isn't indecent exposure within the meaning, as Todd explained, of the current Iowa criminal statute. We'll be back with more from Todd, a few other cases to discuss. We also want to talk about Retirement Watch, U.S. Supreme Court, our Senator Grassley nudging U.S. Supreme Court justices, retire now if you're thinking about it. We'll talk about a little bit of a few headlines he made there. Also, we'll talk about possible retirements on the Iowa Supreme Court and the notorious RBG. She's become a popular culture figure, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm Ben Kiefer with Todd Pettis. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Todd Pettis, professor the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College in Law. We'd love to have Todd on our program to talk about, in this case, Iowa Supreme Court cases, very interesting questions being seen through a legal lens and then decided. We wanted to have Todd comment on a couple of other state cases before some other matters we want to have him comment on. But first of all, of course, in our news, the U.S. Supreme Court acting to bust Nevada's monopoly on legal sports betting. It's a ruling that allows more states to get in on the action and also to reap those tax benefits. So we have a lot of the coverage here. I just want to ask you very simply, Todd, dozens of states across the country prepared to move forward, obviously, to quickly offer sports betting in the wake of this decision. What does it mean for Iowa?
It means Iowa can do it if Iowans want to do it, until or unless Congress writes a new statute that fixes the problems with this old one and says that they can't. Mm-hmm. So if Congress does want to write a new law saying there's no gambling on sports, they almost definitely have the power to say that. But there is no such statute in place now. What had been in place was a statute saying it's not a federal crime to engage in sports gambling, but states, you can't allow it. So it's basically the federal lawmakers telling state lawmakers what they had to do. And the court said, you can't do that. If you feds want to make it a crime yourself, fine, you know, you can do that. But you can't tell the states, the other sovereign in our federal system of government, can't tell the states what they can and cannot make legal.
Right, and Nevada was grandfathered in. That's why
they were.
They're allowed to even as. So if they don't act, we could have betting on the Hawks, the Panthers, and the
sure.
Cyclones, right?
We could.
All right. Let's go back to state court cases before the Supreme Court. This has already been decided. The city of Eagle Grove v. Callahan Investments. Give us a quick idea of what that was about and how it was decided.
Right. So imagine in your neighborhood there's a home or other building that just looks awful to the point of being dangerous. It looks like the roof is going to collapse any day now. Maybe there's broken windows and you see raccoon families going in and out. No sign of life, and you think, boy, this thing's an eyesore. We need to get rid of this. So you call up your city government. City sends out somebody in a truck. They look at it and think, you know what? You're right. We got to do something about this. So what can they do? Well, the city could buy the property using their what we call their eminent domain power if they want to use this land for some public purpose, like maybe make a park out of it. They could issue an order, go to a court and ask the court to issue an order telling the owner they had to fix the problems. Or after 2004, there's another option, and that option is if the property is deemed abandoned, and I'll explain what that means, the city can just take the land.
With no compensation.
With no compensation whatsoever.
Not a dime.
And that's what they did with these two properties owned by Cahalan Investments. They're two properties appeared to be falling apart, abandoned in the eyes of the city at least. And the city said, you got 2 weeks to fix things. They didn't get fixed. And then the city said, we'll pay you $2,000 each for them. And they said, oh, that's less than we paid for these properties. No, how about something much more? And then the city said, invoking this option they have under the 2004 law, how about we just take it for free? We're not going to pay you a dime. And the property owner said, well, that's a taking of our property without payment of just compensation, which the Constitution forbids. And the Supreme Court said, nope, it's not a problem. You can do this. So what are the signs of abandoned property? Does anybody live there? And the statute spells out some of these. Does anyone live there? Have the property taxes been paid? Are the utilities connected? Are there building code violations that make it dangerous? Are vermin, as the statute puts it, mm-hmm. present? Has the lawn been mowed? Has the owner been doing anything in an effort to solve these problems? If not, it looks like the owner has abandoned the property and the city can then just take it.
And the reasoning very quickly?
The reasoning is that when you buy property, you're not buying the right to do whatever you want with that property. There's some restrictions that are placed. And when you buy property, you're buying it subject to the understanding that if you abandon it or create what the law sometimes calls a public nuisance, something that's dangerous.
An eyesore,
you can
too.
An eyesore, but not just an ugly one, a dangerous one, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or something that's a threat to public health or safety. You know, kids may go in there and play and then the roof collapses mm-hmm. on them, or people are getting hurt because of all the jagged glass and tetanus would be cases, you know, waiting to happen,
yeah.
something like that. And so when you buy property, it's subject to the understanding that if you abandon the property within the meaning of the statute, you could lose it altogether.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. One other case. Let's go quickly through Schmidt v. State. So this is one where someone pled guilty and then later said, no, I want to retract that. I want to plead innocent or at least withdraw my guilty plea.
Yeah, way back in 2007 or so, a man named Jacob Schmidt, who was 17 at the time, though the fact that he was a minor doesn't have any role in the case. So Jacob Schmidt pled guilty to incest and to assault with intent to commit sexual abuse. And what had happened, he had a stepbrother. He went to the they shared a mother, but not a father. He went to the stepbrother's house, stepfather's house. Stepfather leaves. And the evidence at the time suggests that when the stepfather leaves, Jacob Schmidt tells the stepbrother to take off his pants, takes off his own pants. Stepfather has forgotten a pack of cigarettes, comes back to the house to retrieve the cigarettes, doesn't know where the boys are, so goes looking for them. And he says that when he finds them, ultimately, Jacob Schmidt is just on the verge of trying to anally penetrate his stepbrother. Police are called. Charges are filed of various kinds. He enters a plea bargain, which is how most criminal cases are resolved, is through plea bargains. And he says, look, if you drop the most serious charges against me, I'll plead guilty to the crimes I mentioned, incest and assault with intent to commit sex abuse. Well, time passes. The stepbrother reaches age of majority, and he signs a statement, which is a little ambiguous, but Schmidt reads it as retracting the accusation, and the statement says, when I was 21 years old, I told other people that Schmidt had never touched me in a sexual way or sexually abused me. And it goes on a couple more sentences. And so Schmidt says, this is evidence that I never really did it. And the legal question is, when you plead guilty to a crime, so you're sent to prison and you're just doing your time in prison, time goes by and you think you've come upon new evidence that proves that you're innocent. Can you file a petition? It's called a petition for post-conviction relief. But basically, can you bring into play a court proceeding to try to get your conviction set aside or to get yourself released from jail because you're actually innocent of the crime? And in this case, when Schmidt pled guilty, he had a very detailed exchange with the trial judge. I mean, the trial judge recited the specific physical points of contact and other, you know, very bare details about what had happened that night and possibly on other occasions too. And Schmidt said, that's right, that's what happened. And now he wants to say, well, actually, that's not what happened. The Iowa Supreme Court split 4-3 on this. All the other cases we've talked about today, I believe, were 7-0. Mm-hmm. This case was 4-3. A majority of the court said, yes, under our Constitution and its principles of fairness and our notions of, you know, kind of the heinousness of letting people be imprisoned for crimes they didn't commit, there's got to be an opportunity, even if you've pled guilty, because people plead guilty for different reasons, even when they're innocent, there's got to be a chance to revisit. Three justices of the on the court said, what about the principle of finality? The guy pled guilty. He said he did it. And at some point, we have to call a case done. Moreover, we're not that terribly persuaded by this guy's evident recantation. So if people are supposed to have this right, we should have waited for a stronger case of actual innocence than this one, where to them, at least, it looks pretty flimsy.
Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa College of Law, the last of the Iowa Supreme Court cases this session that Todd is explaining in depth. And we'll move on now to some other court news that you've been hearing in the news. Let's take this first of all. Our U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley in the news recently for comments about the U.S. Supreme Court justices. Of course, Chuck Grassley, the Senate Judiciary Chairman, so his words count here. And speaking last week on the conservative talk radio show, the Hugh Hewitt Show, Senator Grassley said he wants Supreme Court justices weighing retirement to do it now before the midterm elections.
We've got to get this done before the election, and there's generally about 50, 60, 70 days between the time a president nominates somebody and we get a hearing in committee, and then another 2 weeks before it gets to the floor, and this has to be done before the November election. So my message to any one of the nine Supreme Court justices, if you're thinking about quitting this year, do it yesterday.
Okay, Senator Grassley, last week. This is all tied up in, well, let's go back to the death of the Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia dying suddenly in early 2016. His Republican colleagues would not hold hearings. This is during the Obama presidency, the last year. Then Barack Obama's replacement pick, Merrick Garland. So connect the dots here. So we're having the Senate Judiciary Chairman make this comment: "Hurry up and retire if you're thinking about it."
Well, what the Republicans in the Senate at the time President Obama was in office, including our Senator Grassley, who, as you say, holds this very important position of chairing the Senate Judiciary Committee. The position the Republicans took then was that when a vacancy occurs, such as through a death, in the same year or within a year of a presidential election, we ought to keep that seat vacant until there's an election so that the people can use that presidential election as their opportunity to weigh in on who the new justice should be. It's an indirect way of doing it, but you're basically choosing the chooser. The president is the one who gets to nominate somebody. And so let's add that to the slate of issues that people are going to be voting on in the fall. And so evidently what Senator Grassley is looking at here is a couple different things, I think. One, what if the Republicans lose control of the Senate? He's not going to be the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee anymore, mm-hmm. and it's going to be a whole different ballgame then when the Democrats are running the show looking at Trump's nominees. And then even looking beyond that, if the Republicans hold the Senate, we get a year or so after this coming election, that is to say within a year of the next presidential election, and Democrats are going to be looking at Republicans saying, okay, if a vacancy occurs now, I assume you still hold to the same principle, which is even though you have the power to push this person through, any Trump nominee, you shouldn't do it because we're now within a year. I think seeing those possibilities.
Which Grassley called the Biden rule, which he was leaning on that heavily the whole time he was holding up this nomination of Merrick Garland.
Right. I don't think the Democrats ever took action on this, certainly not with the Supreme Court nominee. But, you know, this is how things work in politics. You're trying to say the other side has agreed that this is the rule.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move on. A quick comment about retirements in our Iowa Supreme Court. Are there coming changes? Are there people who may retire?
Justice Bruce Zager has announced that he's retiring at the end of the term. And so Governor Reynolds this fall will have an opportunity to choose from among a slate of names that she is presented with by a judicial nominating commission. And so we're going to have at least one change. And, of course, it's possible that there may be others as well. So we have a 7-member court. And so in that sense, each one, you know, the United States Supreme Court has 9. The Iowa Supreme Court has 7. And we have had some 4-3 splits. This case that we talked about, the Schmidt case that we talked about, someone wanting to say, I know I pled guilty, but now I want to argue that I'm actually innocent. That's 4-3. We've had a lot of juvenile sentencing cases where we've had a good number of 4-3 decisions and on other issues too. And so any of these vacancies matter, and who's in office to choose, who's in the governor's mansion to choose the next justice is very important. So yeah, during the balance of the year, the coming year or two, we may well see 1 or 2 at least changes on our own court.
Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law wanted to reserve the final minutes of our hour as we talk about court news to talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the icon status she has achieved, at least among some people here in the United States. There's a new documentary released this month that looks at the life and work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, telling great stories of her marriage to Martin. She called him Marty Ginsburg, of course. Showing that in many ways they were opposites, yet soulmates. Her influence in championing the rights of women in her pre-Supreme Court career. She was a civil rights attorney. Let's hear a little clip from the documentary. This is called RBG, just out this month. And the justice, this is when she's not on the Supreme Court, the justice that you'll hear question her is former Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist from the documentary RBG.
Men and women are persons of equal dignity, and they should count equally before the law.
You won't settle for putting Susan B. Anthony on the new dollar.
When they would say things like this, how did you respond?
Well, never in anger, as my mother told me. That would have been self-defeating. Always as an opportunity to teach I did see myself as kind of a kindergarten teacher in those days, because the judges didn't think sex discrimination existed. Well, one of the things I tried to plant in their minds was, think about how you would like the world to be for your daughters and granddaughters.
The gender line helps to keep women not on a pedestal, but in a cage.
Okay, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Comment on this. Neither of us, we should mention, have seen this documentary, certainly on our watch list, I think.
Yes.
Todd, if you agree with me. Tell us, how did Ruth Bader Ginsburg come to be perhaps the most famous Supreme Court justice in the last 100 years, perhaps ever?
Well, here's the way I would frame it. You'll remember that back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and continuing up to the early 1980s, this nation had a great debate, a long debate, about the Equal Rights Amendment, an amendment that would add text to the federal Constitution explicitly saying that states and the government cannot discriminate between people based on their sex. Our Constitution, as written, does not have a provision. It's one of the few Western constitutions that lacks a provision like that. And the Equal Rights Amendment would have changed it. That amendment failed. They came up three states, you know, it has to be ratified by a supermajority of states. Iowa was ratified it very quickly. I think they were fourth in line. But then the movement really slowed down. You may recall Phyllis Schlafly and the Eagle Forum saying, well, this means that women are going to be subject to the draft, talking about right to abortion, talking about same-sex marriage. I mean, it's interesting to look at where we are now and some of the dangers that she was pointing to. And so they came up three votes short. Well, why don't we have it? Why are we not having an argument today about the Equal Rights Amendment? Certainly, this is an era of sex equality and Me Too and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we don't is that the United States Supreme Court very substantially changed the way that it reads the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the protection that it gives women and men against being discriminated against based on their sex. Why did they change? Praise is owed to lots of people, but no one more than Justice Ginsburg. She, as a member of the Rutgers Law Faculty and then the Columbia Law School Faculty, where, by the way, she became the first tenured woman to serve on the Columbia Law School Faculty, she argued cases before the Supreme Court having to do with sex equality. She ran the ACLU's Women's Rights Project, which was trying to get the ERA passed and was also pushing this litigation campaign. She wrote a lot of the important briefs. You just had that clip of her arguing in front of the Supreme Court. And over time, you know, it took a period of a long time. The court started to change the standards that it applied, the tests that it applied when women or men came to court and said, I'm being singled out because of my sex. I'm being treated less favorably. And the court basically just really ratcheted up the standard. And one of the cases that locks that standard in, we might know it as the VMI case. It's a case called United States versus Virginia from the mid-1990s, where Justice Ginsburg, now on the Supreme Court, having been placed there by President Clinton, she wrote the opinion. And the test, in a nutshell, is if a state wants to distinguish between people based on their sex, they have to have, as she put it, an exceedingly persuasive justification. That's something that's very, very hard to show. And so in the Virginia case, for example, the court held that VMI, Virginia Military Institute, could not say to female applicants, we don't allow you. They had to allow female applicants in. And so she really helped lead, with some others too. I mean, again, credit is owed to lots of places, but to none more so than her. So to those who think sex equality is a good thing, which I assume is your entire listener base, she really is a figurehead for them. We had final exams last week, and as a good luck charm, one of my students came wearing a T-shirt with her portrait on the front. That was her good luck charm for doing well.
The picture of her with a crown.
With the crown, the yes, notorious RBG.
The notorious RBG, featured in a comic opera, a workout book. She's a big workout fanatic. She's a popular, there's a top popular Tumblr fan blog, a children's book, a compilation of her speeches. She has her own impersonator on Saturday Night Live. Her face on tote books, tote bags. You mentioned T-shirts, also on coffee mugs. So this is very interesting.
And remember, too, her dearest friend on the court was Justice Scalia. her dearest friend on the court was Justice Scalia.
At the very opposite end of the spectrum.
That's right. And they would joke and say, you know, you don't have to be right. And, you know, one of us can't be right, and I'm sorry, and one of us has to be wrong, and I'm sorry it's you who has to be wrong all the time. You know, I mean, they would they had very different views about the role of the court.
Let's hear a quick clip. I think we have time for this. This is from Justice Ginsburg on The Late Show with comedian Stephen Colbert. Stephen visiting Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the gym inside the Watergate Apartments in D.C.
I was told not to ask her about any pending cases before the court, but I just had to press her on one of the most divisive issues facing our country.
Is a hot dog a sandwich?
You're asking me? Well, you tell me what a sandwich is, and then I'll tell you if a hot dog is a sandwich.
A sandwich is two pieces of bread with almost any type of filling in between, as long as it's not more bread.
You said two pieces of bread. Does that include a roll that's cut open, but still not completely?
See, that's the crux you've gotten immediately. See, this is why you're on the Supreme Court. That gets immediately to the question, does the roll need to be separated into two parts? Because a sub sandwich, a sub is not split, and yet it is a sandwich.
Yes.
So then hot dog is a sandwich?
On your definition, yes, it is.
Well played, Lady Justice.
Okay. Justice Ginsburg with Stephen Colbert a few weeks back. Interesting. Thank you for your comments on all of these cases. Boy, we had a furious pace here, but it was delightful. Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan B. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you so much, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. It's a Politics Wednesday edition tomorrow. We hope you'll tune in for that. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.